welcome to the Yes Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, founder of Yes to Life, the UK charity I set up to support people with cancer in finding all the resources they need for body, mind and spirit to help them to face the immense challenges of cancer. As part of that, I host this show each week and I speak to experts around the world to find out about all the latest developments and practices in integrative cancer care. My guest this week is well known for her advocacy of the ketogenic diet. Her own personal experience was the catalyst for her work, as we'll hear in this interview. I'm speaking to Patricia Daly, no relation, over the internet in Ireland. Patricia, welcome to the Yes to Life Show.
Hi Robin, thanks so much for having me.
Well, would you believe it's more than 5 years since you were last on the show speaking about the ketogenic diet? Well, a lot of water's gone under the ketogenic bridge in that time, I think. So we've got plenty to catch up on. Back then, you'd only just published your book, The Ketogenic Kitchen. It was to go on to be very successful, but also to attract lots of controversy. Some people listening might say to themselves, what, a cookery book, controversial? But I think they might be very surprised at the kind of responses your book elicited. Do you want to say a little bit about your experience following publishing the book?
Sure, yeah. I think, yeah, my co-author, Dominic Kemp, and I, we were very much taken by surprise as well at how much, upheaval or also, I think, upset, or I don't know how to best call it, it caused at the time. Because we basically wrote the book that we would have loved to have when we were both going through our cancer journey. And that's one of the reasons why we came together. And Dominic actually was a client of mine back in 2013. And by working together, we saw, gosh, there's just nothing like what we want, what we need. And we both have a very similar story. Dominic had melanoma in her 20s. She had treatment then and then had breast cancer in her 40s. And that's when she came to me. And I had in 2008, I was diagnosed with malignant ocular melanoma and sort of had recurrences every 2 years, almost like Swiss clockwork, literally. Right. And that's what brought me into the world of ketogenics, metabolic health in 2012. That's when I started, but I started researching in 2010. So, yeah, when we published a book, we thought, gosh, this is going to really help so many people. And especially what we were told when we were asked, I mean, I was never even, diet was never even a topic of discussion in my case at the time. And when you looked it up, it was, yeah, it doesn't matter what you eat, just eat a healthy, balanced diet. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know, it's such a bland thing to say. It's one man's idea of a healthy, balanced diet. It certainly won't be another's.
Exactly. It's just one size fits all. And I was always very interested. I still think insulin is really a big, big deal. And when I look back at my own story, at my blood work, at my symptoms, I was even tested for diabetes while I was going through cancer treatment because I was so all over the place. And we were sort of, should we call it the insulin inhibiting kitchen? And then we're, no, we have to call it something, you know, people have no idea what that is. And then it gets mixed up with diabetes. So yeah, let's just go with the box standard ketogenic. Even then in 2016, we weren't aware that this was such an emerging topic. It was so outlandish for a lot of medical professionals. Lots of medical professionals confused it with ketoacidosis, diabetic or alcohol-induced ketoacidosis. And that topic of confusion, it's still there. We still have to battle against it. So I think, yeah, there were lots of different factors why it was very controversial. It was very new. Again, as I said, everybody always said it doesn't matter what you eat, and then all of a sudden ketogenic was dangerous, and we were whole territorial battlefield as well. It is really quite, you know, you have to stay in your lane. Even oncologists are told sometimes, who are really into nutrition and metabolic health, they're told by nutrition professionals that they are not an expert in this topic and to please not talk about it. So there's all this political, territorial, whatever else sort of going on as well, I think, definitely. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's quite difficult to handle, isn't it, though? Because it's not just, mild-mannered banter. It's actually people are so vitriolic about their views that it can be not nice at all to be on the receiving end of them.
Yeah, and I guess that's what also told us we're on the right track. Because if we were so wrong about everything, and if there was absolutely no evidence, why would we then cause or attract so much attention?
Interesting, right. Well, that's a very positive interpretation of a nasty experience.
You have to, otherwise it's hard, you know, not to give up. But I think we're both so passionate about it. We see it all the time. I mean, I have so many clients going through this journey, and it's just really beneficial if it's done right.
Okay. So we're talking 14 years since you were diagnosed with this rather nasty ocular melanoma. And it's your own remarkable success in tackling this condition through diet that's made you such a dedicated advocate of ketogenics. So since its application to cancer is relatively new in terms of the fact it's been around a long time, the ketogenic diet, but not for cancer, and also it happens to have attracted an unusual level of scientific interest as a diet. Very few diets attract any interest at all. I'm sure that the understanding of the field's advanced quite a bit since we last spoke. So I'm interested in what remains for you unchanged and what new perspectives have you adopted in those 14 years?
Yeah, gosh, that's a big question. So I think I was in the fortunate position that back then there wasn't that much information out there. There wasn't that much social media and so many influences. And that's the one thing that I really work with my clients on. It's please stop constantly tuning out to experts, to reading all the science there is, learning all about pathways and just, almost becoming, having a PhD yourself and becoming completely overwhelmed. Because there are a million choices, you could spend your day trying to take the right decision and you still don't know if it is the right decision. And you end up overwhelmed and actually not doing anything. So for me, from the very beginning, I had quite a simple, I'm not saying simple is easy, but I had quite a simple approach to what I was doing. And I was very dedicated and focused about it. Not obsessed. I think that's important as well. I have two children. When I started this journey, I had an 8-month-old and a barely 2.5-year-old. So there wasn't that much time to, basically 24/7, just looking after absolutely everything in terms of my own journey. That was just not an option. And quite a lot of options weren't available due to limitations with the kids, financially, professionally. So I was quite lucky, I think, that I was very focused. I kept it quite simple. And I also have a type of cancer where you can see the results straight away. So that was very fortunate. And then once I knew, okay, this seems to be working, obviously with my consultant, I started to really... It's like peeling the layers of an onion. Okay, what else needs addressing? What else is wrong? And I think I still had up till about 2018. I was just talking about that yesterday to someone. I had lingering side effects like headaches, which I always attributed to radiotherapy that I had quite intensively with a radioactive plaque stitched to the back of the eye, but then also proton beam. External radiotherapy and obviously surgery 3 times. So I always thought, I just have to live with them. Then I started to really look into detox and especially nutrigenomics. What are my weaknesses? Where are things potentially going wrong for me? What can I improve and optimize? And then I did, I looked at the heavy metals. I had a big inflammation actually on my tooth. So I think dental health is hugely important for some people. And so I had that taken out and I have a denture now. And in combination with really focusing on detox, now my headaches are gone, wow, which obviously has a impact as well. So it's really, and then starting to, you know, track my sleep a little bit as well and optimizing food according to my hormones. I never did this, all this at the beginning, because it's not necessary. At the beginning, I think it's really, okay, how can we get results? How can we find out this even works? Right. And just step by step, and some people do 10 things at once and you never really figure out then, okay, what is actually sustainable, what works, yeah, and true, should I continue to do? Yeah. And I think it's interesting because I'm by nature quite an impatient person and I love to just, yeah, get things done and, you know, trying before thinking too hard. But I think it's really what, when I look back, what really stood to me was to take it slowly, to be patient, to see what works, mm, and what maybe works so well, and be deliberate in my choices.
Well, as you say, you had a big advantage in that you could see the results of your actions as you went. I mean, you literally, your eyesight got better as it got better. Is that right?
Yeah, I was nearly blind in 2012, and because the optic nerve had to be irradiated, the tumor was so close to the optic nerve, and I was told, "Look, there's no chance. It's just gonna go. Your vision is gonna go." Within 18 months of treatment, and then it came back, and the optic nerve is lighting up nicely on photographs, and yes, and I still have it. I just had my scan there two weeks ago, and my vision is holding up.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. But that's an unusual situation for people with cancer. Normally they have to do tons of stuff and then at a certain point they get a scan or whatever it is and they find out what happened and they sit there waiting for the awful news. That's definitely must have been a help to you to have that constant monitoring system. It's also very assuring, you know, when you actually see that you're getting results, that you know you're onto something and you step on the gas and get more committed.
Yeah.
Mm.
Definitely.
Yeah,
and I think in terms of the science as well, we just learn more and more also in terms of epigenetics, which is really exciting that there are big epigenetic shifts happening when somebody is embarking on a ketogenic diet and producing ketones, which we know are signaling molecules as well as much as an energy source. And I think that's very exciting. But just all the other potential beneficial effects. It's not just this whole sugar feeds cancer. And that's what we always said back in 2016.
Yeah, it started off as a simple picture, like most things. And it was going to fix everybody, you know, the ketogenic diet at one time. As you say, a lot more is known about it now. And it's obviously known to be a particular help to some groups of cancers, isn't it? And not so much so for others. So that's really useful knowledge to have. Must have been some disappointed people trying it, I expect, for things that it didn't really work for. But I
see people, you know, saying, okay, I was on a ketogenic diet and it just didn't work. And I was, okay, let's have a look and let's see what you did. And it turns out also looking at nutrigenomics, where you can really dial in terms of, you know, certain nutrients that have got to be there. And also, should you be more plant focused or do you have to have some animal foods? All those little helps, they make life a lot easier. And some people, they follow a ketogenic diet according to a book, but they never measure anything. And a ketogenic diet is not, you can't just follow the meal plans in our book without all the additional information that we have there in terms of monitoring, in terms of testing. Everybody goes into ketosis in their own style and in their own way. And I think that's the nice thing to some extent as well. For some of my clients, it's effortless. And for others, it's not. And we have to figure out why they're not producing ketones or why they're not using them. So, that's.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, well, look, you've mentioned a few things and I haven't butted in there, but they're all sort of side issues, if you like, that you've taken on board over the time. One of them was genomics. Now, I think it'd be interesting to just say a bit more of why that's been important to you and what that information helps you to ascertain and how it's actually helped you to tailor your treatment.
Yeah, in terms of, I think just especially micronutrients, it is very interesting when you look at your nutrigenomic profiles or your blueprint. So it's not like tumor profiling. Some people or even oncologists, they basically mix those things up. It's not like taking a biopsy and then doing the profiling, the genetic profiling of your tumor. It's really your blueprint. And any genetic variant, so single nucleotide polymorphisms, as we call them, they generally emerge as an adaptation to the environment. So it's important to understand this is not good or bad, not at all. There's no good or bad genes as such. It all makes sense when you have an idea where you're from. So in my case as well, I have quite a lot of genetic variants on genes that help me convert plant nutrients or nutrients from plants into the functional form. So for instance, beta carotene into the functional vitamin A. So that's one issue I have, which is very interesting because I did go on a completely vegan plant-based diet in my teens and my eyesight and my immunity really suffered.
Interesting. So just put simply there, you know, a normal person or a person with their genes not mutated at all would be able to eat a bunch of carrots and they'd get a lot of good vitamin A, which would be good for their sight, amongst other things.
The functional, exactly, the functional.
Yeah. So you had a propensity for not being able to do that very well.
Yeah, exactly. And that obviously has big impacts on eyesight, on immunity, and obviously all the other aspects that are influenced by that. And the same as well happens for instance, ALA, so the omega-3s from plant conversion into EPA, DHA. So I have that as well, that I have to eat fish. So I have to eat eggs and liver and vitamin A. Forms that are not found in plants. So in plants, it's always the precursors that then have to be converted. So for me, that made a lot of sense looking back. And it just also when people ask me, you know, can I go fully vegan or not? And I was, okay, let's have a look. To be vegan, then you probably have to supplement and you have to know this because you could run into trouble. And yeah, also in terms of saturated fats versus poly monounsaturated fats, you know, how should those ratios ideally be? And then always comparing with the blood biochemistry and also with, for instance, MTHFR, MTRR, anything that affects the methylation. So that addition of methyl groups to nutrients, genes to, you know, it's such an important aspect obviously in our health, and we need to see if there are genetic variants. Is this actually a problem, or do we manage it well? So one of the simplest ways is to check your homocysteine levels. There are more sophisticated tests as well to check methylation status, but it's not just blindly following the nutrigenomic report, but checking with your bloods, okay, or with other tests sometimes, okay, is this actually a problem or are we managing well with our diet and lifestyle as it is?
That's interesting. So you're looking at sort of both ends of the thing. You're looking at the sort of basis on which you operate, which predicts something or another. And then, of course, your lifestyle can modify that depending on what it's like. So it could make it worse or it could make it better. So, yeah, so you want to check the other end, what's actually happening. And you can immediately then know if it's not happening that well, well, the problem is there in your genes and you need to supplement in order to counteract that.
Yeah, exactly. You can make changes because there are certain weaknesses and then you know that and you know those particular markers you keep an eye, a bit of a closer eye on, or also if you are more susceptible to not responding too well to carbs, okay, let's do, I mean, I generally do that anyway, the glucose testing. I think it's just, it's almost like a game. It's so revealing for people. People are initially sort of, no, I don't really, do I have to do that? And so initially, sometimes we resort to the continuous glucometer so that they can avoid the finger prick test. And then they actually kind of get really intrigued and interested and, okay, what happens if I do this? So what happens if I combine that? And yeah, so it's almost a bit like gamifying it.
Yeah, well, if you're wearing the thing the whole time, you can just experiment, play around, can't you?
Yeah, you definitely, all you need to do is just scan every 8 hours and then it just records everything in between. You can see, what was that spike here?
Right, interesting, yeah.
As well.
Okay, well, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but you actually mentioned also the role and importance of detoxification, which clearly you weren't thinking about when you started out, but it has turned out to sort of play a part in the whole thing. Do you want to just quickly say something about, for you and generally, you find that how important it is?
Yeah, so again, it's looking at, when I look at my genes now, retrospectively, it makes a lot of sense. I had quite high levels of arsenic, mercury and nickel. So I did that test in, I think, 2015 and I addressed it, but only sort of, with a bit of chelation and nothing really sustainable. So I did bring the levels down, but then it turned out they just almost they had a rebound every time.
Really?
I can't constantly chelators. I mean, that's just not sustainable. So what else is going on here? And arsenic is it's an interesting one. And also, again, you can see in your genetic blueprint, okay, maybe some people are much more susceptible of just accumulating them and not getting rid of them. And I'm definitely one of them. And I was traveling before my diagnosis in Asia for quite a while. So I don't know if that had any. And what I then did was I invested in a sauna. That was actually just before, I think it was 2018. And just doing that routinely now, I find is incredibly beneficial. Just also during the winter, it's beneficial for my mental health.
Yeah, people love them. Once they got one, they will want to do it anyway. It's one of the sort of high points for people, especially going through cancer treatment. If they can have a sauna, it's a really nice thing for them to do.
And it is interesting. It's one of my observations that a lot of my clients, they say, gosh, I never sweat or I never used to sweat. And I was exactly the same. Even when I was in Asia, when it was really hot, it just took so much for me to be able to perspire. And then with the sauna now, that's really changed. It's almost teaching your body, okay, it's okay to eliminate. And so now it's a bit warm outside and I work out. I manage to sweat.
Right. How about that?
Yeah. And important for detox. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So when you started out on your quest for solutions, you were giving all your attention to the practicalities of microbiology and everything that was so essential to controlling your cancer, and with obvious great success. But over time, the psychological and emotional factors involved have begun to take your attention, I understand. So why was this?
Yeah, I think it was also through the book. It triggered a lot of things, and it was almost like a sort of a trauma that honestly I found it quite tough being faced with all those different allegations. And I think that's what mainly also just got me into this field, and also my daughter, interestingly, who has always suffered from low level anxiety. It got quite bad at times, and so I brought her to someone who does it's biomagnetic therapy that I started doing with her, and it was just so amazing what I saw happening in her. And I had always had this desire to go more into this field as well, the emotional field, because I'm convinced, for me, I'm not saying it caused cancer or anything, but it was a big contributor. And also when working with clients, it is something that always comes up. And I don't know if that's just the type of clients I attract as well, but it is definitely something that is always there, and then can get re-triggered. And really working on all those aspects, the emotional aspects. And I'm not saying, I mean, I think trauma is fascinating. It's not necessarily what happens to us. It's our response.
How we interpret it, yeah. Exactly.
And people can go through the same event, and one person can't even remember it, and the other one gets hugely influenced, and the way they behave, they go on in life, and they respond to people, challenges, is very different. So I find that just fascinating, how we're obviously we have all this energy in us, and we are ultimately energy beings that we can tap into, and really also, you know, feeling the feelings. I guess that's something when I grew up, I it's not that you have to learn it, but it wasn't necessarily modeled to me. So it's not something that came naturally to me, and that I really almost had to learn and rediscover. Okay, it's safe to feel the feelings. I don't need to push them away or just, you know, get on with it. You know, there is a place sometimes for getting on with it, but definitely sometimes that's a very damaging thing to say. And really learning all about this type of work and how important it is. And I think at the conference, New Life and Cancer Conference, it came quite a bit as well.
It did, yeah.
Now epigenetically, we have the more and more of the science. I mean, Bruce Lipton, when he first came up with this in the 1970s, and the whole doctor, they all left the room when he was talking about this. Oh, come on. And now we actually know this. And I was looking on PubMed, I was looking around a bit the other day, and there are some really decent reviews and papers in 1989 that already talked about this, emotions and the onset of cancer. I'm sort of, wow. I mean, it's been around for quite a long time, but we just haven't quite, again, like a lot of things in cancer treatment, we haven't quite incorporated this.
No.
And it's fascinating.
Yeah. Most of medicine is based on sort of keeping a professional distance and generally not engaging in an emotional level with patients. It's hardly surprising that things to do with dealing with emotions and accommodating them and growing around them are completely missed out. I mean, it's no surprise, really, but it's a tragedy there.
Yeah, or even the choice of words, you know,
even
because the words are so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And they really can totally go in on a cellular level. And, you know, I sometimes say to my clients, I wish they would let go of the notion of prognosis, because it can in some of my clients, that was such a trauma to hear this. And it's almost like, okay, it's almost like programming a death.
Yeah.
Or installing a death program. And I wish, you know, that the choice of words and the way it is communicated. I don't expect the medical professionals to go in and do trauma work, not at all.
No.
Just how they deal and how they talk and communicate will make a huge difference.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. The prognosis is a difficult thing. I mean, plenty of people ask for it, but it's like, it's a made up number, which is totally unrepresentative of the kind of people who are as proactive as you and I deal with. It doesn't have much to do with them at all. It's to do with some average, which is based on a huge number of people doing nothing whatsoever other than they're doled out with at the hospital, which of course skews it ridiculously in the wrong direction.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip, because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All right, so you mentioned at the beginning, talking about the kind of psychological and emotional things, you mentioned this business of fear of missing out, you know, people going berserk, reading everything because they think they're going to miss that key thing that's going to save their life. It's interesting, isn't it, how that, if you look at it as a strategy to try and learn everything about everything, it doesn't work, actually. You can say that quite safely, can't you? It actually leads to a kind of paralysis, usually, and there are very few people can handle that much information and still be decisive.
Exactly. Yeah. And I do feel sometimes, that, as you say, the paralysis can be huge. And then just, even with food, you know, the fear of eating because they are scared of fueling.
Yeah.
And I was, okay, if you go in with that mindset to every single meal, and we know how absolutely powerful our thoughts and our emotions are, but our thoughts, they can have an impact on gene expression, and we know that. So what is that? If you go in with that thinking into your meal, you're probably creating some sort of miscommunication, and it's almost then becoming like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So can you go in with the mindset of I am eating to strengthen and fuel all my healthy cells so that I am able to heal? Can you do that?
Right. Just change, a bit more like it.
That mindset and our self-talk, it's absolutely incredible. When we listen to ourselves, what stories we have running in our head.
So I want to look on the other side, if you like. There's these two methods we can have for approaching our choices that we go forward with. And one of them is learning. There's nothing wrong with that and getting wised up. But there can have its downsides, as we just pointed out, if you sort of get carried away with it. So an important inner navigation system that gets more and more airtime, particularly since Kelly Turner brought out her book Radical Remission, is intuition, which is the other way you can find your way forward. So lots of people are beginning to realise it's an essential way of getting through the myriad of choices and uncertainties too. All this comes when you start to take charge of your own treatment plan rather than just being a passive recipient of treatment. So to some people, intuition just comes naturally, but to many others, lots of others, it's total foreign territory, I think. The good news is it does seem to be a bit like a muscle, that once you make a start with it, it does get stronger with use, and you find you're able to rely on it more and more.
Yeah.
So can we start by talking a bit
more about the importance of a truly personalised approach to healthcare and the role of intuition in that.
Yeah, I think the importance, I mean, we've just talked about it. We're all so different in terms of our physical health, our blueprint, what our body truly needs to come, which has evolved in a different environment to your friends, for instance, who you're comparing your protocol with. And also, yeah, just using those tools to personalize. So for me, nutrigenomics and then blood biochemistry, you know, it can be very standard panels with some obviously extra markers that can sometimes be a bit trickier to get. And then glucose, I think glucose tracking can be really, really useful in terms of, okay, how do I respond to this? And it's not just the food, obviously, that moves our glucose. It is our emotions. It is, you know, when we are very stressed, our glucose will go up, or when we haven't slept well. It's such a great gauge for me generally as well to see, okay, how am I doing? Am I getting completely overwhelmed? Or do I need to address and change something? So, and for me, these three are really, you know, sort of the pillars. And then, of course, you can add some other tests to personalize that depends on your type of cancer, on your genomic weaknesses, and on your symptoms and your well-being. And of course, you know, finding, and I think that's where the trust comes in. I always say the tumor in most people has got to be addressed in some shape or form, but I'm not an oncologist. I know how to treat the whole person. I don't know how to treat tumors. So you need to find someone who is really good at that. And then we take care of you, of the tumor environment, so to speak. And then the intuition part, yeah, as you say, it is like a muscle, and it's almost a little bit like a discipline. Okay, if it makes you anxious to be, you know, not to know enough, and I'm the same. I mean, otherwise I wouldn't do what I'm doing now. I went into this. I signed up for a nutritional therapy 3-year course 3 weeks after completing my radiation treatment, and so I totally relate to that hunger for knowledge, just to really find out and learn. And that hunger for learning and knowledge is completely great, unless it becomes obsessive. And what can help is just to put away pockets of research. I have to do that myself as well. I have pockets where I have dedicated research, but then to let it go and have pockets of honing that intuition. So there are so many great ways. So journaling can be brilliant. So it can be initially with prompts that you get to reflect on something and you write about it. 5 minutes a day can be enough. Some people, they get a lot out of meditation and they find that really useful. I personally quite like moving meditation. So I do every morning, I'm out in the garden, I do the 5 Tibetan rites, where I just tune into my body. How are we doing? What hurts? What is strong? What is having a bit of an issue today? How am I in terms of my mental health, my motivation? And just, again, having small tools that you can incorporate on a daily basis, and then just stick with it. Don't say after a week, oh, this doesn't work. And it doesn't do anything. It all, again, it's a matter of patience, isn't it? And just honing those different, it is a skill ultimately. And maybe remembering as well, sometimes I think that's really useful. Can we remember instances in our childhood or in, you know, when we were growing up or even recently where my intuition worked really well? Just do a list. When did it work really well for me?
Right.
That can be quite revealing as well. And how did you feel when you got a very clear, I mean, intuition is our inner teacher. When did something come up very clearly from within and just, this is true, or this is what I have to do? And that alone can be quite a revealing exercise that you probably tune into your intuition a lot more than you give yourself credit for.
I think that's probably true of a lot of people, yeah. Yeah, interesting. I mean, you know, critics will say that the intuition stuff's a load of woo-woo. Nothing to do with science. And people should just listen to the experts and do what they say. And, you know, there's something in that, but I don't think it's really an either-or situation.
Exactly.
I think both these things play along beside each other. They're both important, in fact, to actually get wise is important. I can easily say from my experience that the people who learnt about their own condition did better as a result.
Yeah.
But also those people, I'm sure, were also using their intuition, because the decisions you have to make, there isn't enough science to inform the decisions you have to make, is there? It's just not there often. And so you have to use something else, and it is there to guide people. You know, at the end of the day, they learn to use it.
Yeah, and the client of mine once said, you know, my oncologist, my medical team, they are a body of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I am the one who have knowledge of my body.
And right.
That's really exactly what it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I say it's both. It's teamwork. And it's really knowing what do you have to let go of, what do you need to outsource, and what do you decide for yourself. It's a bit like I'm self-employed, I run my own business. I'm not good at everything. I have to outsource certain things.
Right.
people do much better than
they
me.
They do, absolutely. It's good to recognise that. So intuition itself, it's got its basis in the concept, or lots of people would say, in the reality of connectedness. Connectedness is right at the heart of any deep realization of the nature of things. And, you know, this is the fact that we're not separate, disconnected individuals that we imagine ourselves to be, but we're deeply connected to everyone and everything around us, nature, the universe, the whole lot. So this is the kind of basis on which the answers we're needing can become increasingly obvious to us as we're connected to these things. What's kind of interesting is that these concepts are no longer consigned to just the sort of spiritual world. These are actually a matter of science now.
Yeah.
And I was wondering whether that's something you'd looked into at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's, again, I did start to study biomagnetic therapy because the electromagnetic field, as we know, is probably the most powerful thing in the universe, as far as we know. I mean, there could be others, of course, but that's what really started to very much interest me as well. How do animals, for instance, I was always fascinated by birds flying to the
compass. Yeah.
How do they don't have a compass, they have an inner compass. How do they do that? And so I got fascinated by magnetic fields. And then obviously we are constantly exposed as well to magnetic fields. And then really going into the science of what we know, and we know that there's certain companies now developing probiotic supplements with magnets because they know that bacteria migrate in a certain way as well. So can we take advantage of that? And I find that absolutely fascinating as well, how microbes and how microbes vibrate and how they communicate. So it goes into this whole new area of really looking at also observing nature and how do they work? How do they migrate? How do they communicate? And can we take advantage of this? And in 2018, I started to really get into this field, which is more than going into the whole energy medicine field. And
right.
So, and doing my research there, and obviously Bruce Lipton, I think his work, The Biology of Belief, that was really, you know, very groundbreaking in that whole area. And and then I love Gabor Mate's work as well. The Wisdom of Trauma is his documentary that he talks a lot about cancer as well, and how cancer is really also the ultimate disconnect, as you were talking about connection.
Right. Yeah.
Cancer cells, they are completely, they're like, they have, I always say, God, they're like you know, little toddlers, they don't listen. They think, they just, they don't listen to growth or stop signals, and they just are a law to themselves, uncontrollable cell growth, basically. So the cell clusters that are out of control, not connected to the rest of the body. And I find that really, that concept also very interesting.
It is. Yeah. Well, the way the whole body sort of cooperates, all the different elements of the body cooperate to produce this consistent you, is a total miracle, isn't it? And I think the understanding that we now have, the man in the street has, that the number of bugs that inhabit our body is just way more than we would like to imagine. And it puts the idea of you as being sort of somehow a separate entity. Which bit of you is the separate entity? Are we the bugs, or are we something else? You know, it's like you can't get your head around it almost. We are sort of the universe, if you like, is inhabiting us inwardly as well.
Yeah, we're microbes with a human expression.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. It's strange. We're just sort of big vehicles for microbes.
Yeah. That's the thing, exactly. And yeah, we do constantly learn more and more about that. And also, I think Joe Dispenza, I don't know honestly how much research or how much science he has produced, but his whole, some people absolutely swear by his, you know, the visualization. Where do you want to? And you basically, it can become so powerful. And also, I always say, okay, visualize what you can do, what you will do if you don't, you know, if you're finished with treatment. Don't just have the goal of getting through treatment. How will you, what will you do, how you feel, and who will you be? And that visualization piece is really, really works so well for some people. Yeah.
Okay, well, look, I want to get in the advert break here. Since we're talking about this subject, I want to let everybody know about our annual conference this autumn, our first real face-to-face event for more than 2 years. It's going to be in London on the 24th of September and is called Finding a Deeper Connection. So it's focused entirely around connectedness and depth. And we have some absolutely inspirational speakers. So not to be missed, look on the Yes to Life website, yestolife.org.uk, to find out more. That's it. We're kind of out of time. Been a fascinating talk, far too long in coming. Let's not leave it another 5 years.
Yeah, thank you, Robin. It was great talking to you, and thanks for letting me talk about all these things that I'm so passionate about. Yeah, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Robin.
As I mentioned in the interview, our annual conference is on the 24th of September, but coming up very soon is our online panel event, Natural Ways to Deal with Common Side Effects. This will be on the 11th of June, it's ridiculously cheap, and it will feature an extremely impressive lineup of experts poised to answer every question you may have about the side effects of cancer and cancer treatment. It'll be a goldmine of resources. Thanks so much for listening today. I'd love you to join me again next week for another Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.